It was that time of year you can feel the thrill in the air. The busy markets, the buying and the selling of lambs, the smell of roasted meat, if that's you, and freshly baked bread filling the streets of Jerusalem. It really was that time of year. The dinner tables were all prepared, ready to go, family and friends invited to come over. Every household throughout the land was getting ready for the meal. The meal. Every Jew knew the story. They knew the meal. It was in their collective veins. In fact, how could you be called Jew if you did not know the story? It was at the heart of their identity. That week would have marked roughly 1,500 years from the time that they were slaves in the land of Egypt. Since God had liberated them from their slavery, they would retell and remember this epic story of freedom year after year after year for 1,500 years. Except this year, this Passover was going to be a little different than all the other years. You see, the disciples, quietly, they're making their way to the upper part of Jerusalem, eager to spend Passover with their rabbi, Jesus. Jesus, being a great host, had arranged the location of the meal in secret to keep the authorities from finding him and from arresting him prematurely. So that week, there was tension in the air. You can feel it everywhere, all over Judea. After all, what better time to create an uprising than Passover week? The meal, the story of freedom from oppression and corrupt power. What better time to bid for freedom? So, the Roman authorities were smart. They had their eyes and their ears everywhere. Meanwhile, preparations were being made. The room was ready. The table, the plates, the napkins, the wine, the bread, the roast. Everything was set exactly how Jesus wanted it to be. The boys finally arrive to the secret location. Jesus was there. He greeted all of the disciples, all 12 of them, even Judas. There they were, reclined around the table, making small talk about their busyness of the day and the craziness in Jerusalem. Jesus leans forward to speak. And as he does, they begin to quiet down. And he says, "I have been eager to eat this Passover meal with you before my suffering begins. For I tell you now that I will not eat this meal again until it's fulfilled in the kingdom of God." The disciples, hearing Jesus, were puzzled. Suffering? This is Passover. It's about liberation. No one around the table knew what was going on except for the host. And so Jesus, the host, starts the festivities of Passover. He begins. Excitement and anxiety fill the room as they begin to share this meal together. A meal that told a story, an old story. And while they were eating, layered with a mixture of emotions, Jesus reaches for the bread and begins to give thanks for it. Now at this point, the room is quiet. They were listening to every single word intently. After he gives thanks, he breaks the bread and gives it to his disciples and says, "Take this and eat. This is my body given for you." Now this was customary at every Passover meal, every year. The head of the house would take the unleavened bread with bitter herbs, known as the bread of affliction, recalling the suffering and the affliction that they endured in their history back in Egypt. Now, instead of tying the bread to Egypt, Jesus tethers the bread and the bread of affliction to his own body. After eating it,
The disciples look at each other, trying to make sense of what's going on and how and why Jesus would tether the bread to his body. How were they related? In the middle of processing all this, Jesus reaches out again towards the table. But this time, Jesus grabs the cup. And he gives thanks to the Father, and then he gives it to them and says, "Here, drink from it, all of you. This cup is the new covenant in my blood for the forgiveness of sins, which is poured out for you." Now imagine the look of shock on their faces, the broken bread, the cup of freedom, all related to his body and blood. Some of them quietly whispered, "Is this a new Passover meal? How could this old story of our forefathers and foremothers be about his body and his blood? He hasn't even died." They thought to themselves, how could this be? But Jesus knew that his time had come to leave this world and to go back to his Father. Gazing around the table at his disciples with deep love, even Judas was there. Jesus stands up, breaking custom and cultural norms. He takes off his outer coat. He grabs the towel near the front door, wraps it around his waist, pours water into a basin, and gets on his knees. The disciples are looking. They haven't figured it out yet. By now, slowly, they're beginning to feel very uncomfortable. Something weird is about to happen. Nothing about this evening has been normal so far. "What is he doing?" they whispered among themselves. You see, for in those days, it was customary for slaves and servants to engage in the menial task of washing feet of the guests and of masters who would walk into the door of a house. This was an act of hospitality. The disciples realized this whole time that they've been sitting in a house, eating around a table this whole time with dirty feet. Oof. There were no servants at the front door when they walked in. Then the light bulb goes off and they finally figured it out. Jesus was about to wash their dirty, stinky feet. Feet that were in sandals all day in the dirt, on the dirt roads where animals traveled on. Yes, I know what you're thinking. Poopy animals create poopy feet. So what does he do? You see, washing their feet was not a luxury. It was a necessity. They thought to themselves, why now? After we've been sitting here this whole time eating, in the middle of eating, why him and not one of the servants downstairs? To their shock and even embarrassment, Jesus is about to demonstrate what greatness in the kingdom of God actually looks like. Peter, of course, isn't having it. Oh, Peter. This totally clashes with his ego. And he says, "Are you kidding me? There is no way that you are going to touch my feet, Jesus." "Peter," says Jesus, "you don't get it now, but you will afterwards. Peter, you see, if I don't wash your feet now, you have no place with me." Peter didn't get what Jesus was doing. The disciples were still in great shock that Jesus, Israel's true king and long-awaited Messiah, in the middle of leading their Passover meal, the host of the dinner party, gets up, wraps a servant's towel around his waist, kneels down to wash their feet. You see, but Jesus knew the disciples really well. He didn't wash their feet at the very beginning when they walked in, because that would not have worked. He deliberately sat and ate and spoke with them. And in the middle of eating, he gets up and washes their feet. Why would he do that, you might ask? What if the lesson wasn't really about their feet, but about their hearts? What if Jesus was teaching them that servanthood in God's kingdom required surrender? And so Jesus, the Word in the beginning, the creator of the cosmos, humbles himself to a servant gets on his knees and begins to wash the feet of his creatures. You're probably thinking, was Judas there? Yeah, he was there. You see, this is what love looks like because this is who God is. So after he washes their feet, Jesus gathers them around and says, a new commandment I give to all of you. This word commandment in the Latin is mandatum. It's where we get Maundy Thursday. He says, I have a new mandate for you. I give it to you, and here it is. Love one another. Just as I have loved you, you must love one another. Your love for each other will prove to the world that you are my disciples. In a room filled with different backgrounds and vocations and political worldviews and personalities and hopes and dreams and fears, during a time of social and political division and unrest, Jesus gives a new covenant by breaking the bread and pouring the wine. And then he cleanses them by wearing a towel and washing their feet. And now he gives them a new command. That if you are going to be my disciples, then you ought to love each other the way that I have loved you. There's lots of words in the Bible that describe God. God is faithful. God is holy. God is merciful, gracious, compassionate, patient, good, kind, righteous, just, upright, perfect, wise, awesome, mighty, king, sovereign, judge, a shield, a consuming fire, our fortress, deliverer, father, our strength, helper, shepherd, healer, peace, salvation, hope, our guide, our rock, our refuge, a warrior. But if there's one word, a one-word resume that will go even deeper than all of these terms and definitions and characteristics, a word that tells the essence and the nature of who God is, well, it's found in 1 John. Dear friends, let us continue to love one another, for love comes from God. Anyone who loves is a child of God and knows God. But anyone who does not love does not know God. Why? Because God is love. You see, love is at the heart of the Trinity, even in the beginning. For love to exist, you need three things: subject, object, and a relationship. One who loves, one who is loved, and love that is expressed. And all three are found at the heart and the core of God. In Jesus, we see not just love reimagined, but we see it personified. In Jesus, love is not just an action or an idea or an ethic or a fuzzy feeling. It's embodied in a person. And during the last few hours of Jesus' life, all of the words he could have said and all of the teachings that he could have taught, Jesus, God in flesh, lowers himself to the status of a servant, washes feet, and tells us to be servants just like him. This is what love does. So friends, this is the scandalous news of Maundy Thursday. Just 12 hours before Good Friday, this humble, foot-washing, unimpressive servant king would demonstrate the greatest act of love the world has ever known. A God that picks up a towel before he picks up a cross. This is our God. And let us choose to follow him by picking up our towels as well.